the container that we do this inside of matters very little. They're all just tools kind of designed to help us commune with, you know, the God of the universe, right?
Welcome to A Theology of Hustle. Make sure you're subscribed on YouTube or wherever you get your podcast, and follow me at Theology of Hustle on Instagram. Now, let's get to work. Y'all, Zawadi Morrow is back in the house. Zawadi, man, thanks so much for joining me on the podcast again. It's good to see you.
Yeah, 100%. It is a delight to be back, for sure.
I love it. Okay, well, people may not remember kind of your story, and lots has changed since we last chatted. So do you mind kind of giving us the quick rundown of who you are, what you do, that sort of thing?
Yeah, totally. Yeah, my name is Zawadi. I am married, coming up on, oh boy, I got to do the math here. it's been a minute, we'll say.
I get it.
Yeah. We've got two kiddos, both 10, one by adoption and one biological. I'm a worship leader at a church here in the Midwest. I think the last time we talked, I might have been in the Pacific Northwest, perhaps.
You were. You definitely were. I did not know about the Midwest move.
That's so awesome. We can chat more about that.
Okay, cool.
I've been a musician, so to speak, kind of professionally, the sort of whole of my adult life, so to speak. And really grateful to, quote unquote, be able to use music to pay the bills, so to speak. That feels like a real, real gift, these days. Some of my sort of story and background, I was born in the Congo. I was adopted. My parents were missionaries there. They're European, so my dad is Irish, delightful Irish accent, and my mom's from Germany, so she's got a wonderful German accent. I got the gift of kind of being able to grow up across a variety of different continents and cultures and contexts, in the Congo, in Kenya, in Europe for a number of years. My family moved here to the U.S. Back in 2000, I believe. And this was like right before I got into high school. Lived in North Carolina at the time. So that was kind of a fun move. Did high school, did my undergrad in North Carolina. I met my wife there. She's originally from North Carolina. Grateful for, just the relationship that we've had over the years. We dated for 5 years, which was a wonderful through undergrad. We've been married, 2009 is when we got married. So it's been a minute, but it's been a delight. It's been a really, really beautiful journey to get to travel together in this little life journey. So yeah, that's kind of like a real sort of cliff notes. Here's a little bit about who I am.
Yeah, I had forgotten about your parents being Irish and German. I'm now remembering that again.
Yeah.
You embodied so much diversity, like being born in Congo, right?
Yeah.
Parents are missionaries and they come from different cultures, right? European cultures.
Yeah.
And you're kind of, I wonder, were you in, did y'all live in Congo until you moved to the U.S.?
So for high school? I was in the Congo for just a couple of years as a baby, really.
Okay.
And then the bulk of my childhood really was spent in Kenya. So I spent 9 years in Kenya, and that was kind of separated by a handful of years back in Europe, in the UK primarily, in between there. And then been here in the States. since. So yeah, it's been a little bit of everything.
That is a lot of bit of everything. I mean, as somebody who's lived in, you know, two, I guess three places my entire life, and they've all been either Texas or Illinois, you know, yeah. It is hard for me to kind of wrap my mind around that. Even the identity formation for young people. I mean, you have kiddos. Yeah. I'm watching my kids sort of form identity. For you, identity formation seems like it could have been fraught. I'm not sure if that's true or not, but yeah. How do you look back on your childhood and sort of forming your identity as Zawadi?
For sure. It's something I'm genuinely really grateful to my parents for. I think that identity is complicated for anybody. I think if you add a layer of maybe adoption into the picture, that adds a layer to it. If you're adding sort of a cross-cultural or a cross-racial adoption, that adds sort of another layer into it.
Yes.
And so there is for sure layers of that. I think one of the things that I am so grateful to my parents for is that they did such a wonderful job of helping me understand sort of that the primary layer of my identity is sort of who I am in Christ, whose I am, so to speak, and kind of building everything from that place. And kind of then from there, I'm a Maro, right? So how my sort of their cultural background informs kind of our family. And then my sort of addition to the family and the cultural background that I bring sort of all informs what it means to be Amaro. And so the cultural heritage and background that I'm bringing is now sort of kind of engrafted into our sort of family dynamic, and that's enjoyed and celebrated, and they did such a beautiful job of that. And I think I remember distinctly I must have been like in, I don't know, kindergarten or first grade. Some kids were like teasing me at school over something silly. I don't even remember what it was. And I came home and you know, my dad, you know, typical parents, like, how was school, you know? And I was kind of sharing some of that. And I distinctly remember my dad explaining to me that sort of I don't need to allow the kind of other kids to dictate who I am, because that's not something that they can give me. And I like really distinctly remember him saying, like, I'm your father and I'm the one who gets to give you your identity. No one else can do that for you. No one else can take that away from you. It's my responsibility to give that to you just as much as Jesus, right? And that stuck with me even from, you know, kindergarten all the way until, you know, I turned 40 this year. And that's still sort of a fundamental kind of foundational thing that has stuck with me. And even now with my own kids, that's something that I continue to speak into their life of, like, you know, our job is as your mom and dad is to give you that identity. You don't get that from anywhere else. You're ours. We give that to you. You can't take that away. No one else can take that away. And so that helped me understand and feel a real sense of, like, I have place, I have purpose, I am rooted here in this family. Even though we look different externally, even though culturally we're different, you know, I think another two other things that I think were really helpful for my parents that kind of helped prepare them for this. One was that they already were sort of involved in like a cross-cultural marriage, right? My dad was born and raised in Northern Ireland. This is like post, you know, they grew up in kind of post-World War II Europe. My mom's German. So their family backgrounds were so diverse and different, and they had to kind of figure that out together.
Right.
First of all. And then I would say the subsequent follow-up gift to that was that when they adopted me in the Congo, they were missionaries in the village where I was born. And so they already had a sense of place and context. And we lived there for a number of years. And so it wasn't sort of this kind of, you know, drop in from you know, wherever and back out again. They had a sense of place and context. They knew my biological family well. And so there was a real sense of rootedness that I got to grow up with that I think was so fundamental and foundational. And it's something that I try to pass on to my kiddos now as they're moving through life too.
Yeah. That's awesome. I love that. There's lots of thoughts that just come to mind for me there. I've talked to a lot of adult adoptees. We're an adoptive family ourselves. So I like to learn from people who have been through that journey previously. And your story is unlike any adult adoptee I think I've ever talked to, you know, in all of my time. Because most, especially transracial adoptions, the white parents in general are asking their, you know, black or brown children to become white based functionally, going to all white churches, being in all white spaces, living in all white cities. Yep. And very few of them that I've heard of see their parents as being intentional about identity formation. Like, do you, I mean, you're in this world, in the adoption world, like, do you see the same thing there?
Yes, I do. And I think it's tricky because there are so many parents who enter into adoption beautifully. They're beautifully motivated and there's a real sense of, you know, we see the parallels between sort of our faith and what God has done for us, and we see the need in the world. There are children all over the world who need families. And most parents are like, yeah, we've got a family, we can do that, and so they jump into it. And I think that's right, and that's to be celebrated and commended. I think this is becoming more and more known, but I think there are just such deep realities about identity and how we're shaped and formed culturally. Our racial background, all of these things are at play, and all of these things at some point or another in a child's life are going to come up, and there's going to be questions, and there's going to be, you know, how do I relate to myself in these various parts of my story and my background? And I think as my wife and I are in this space, and we've got a lot of friends who are in this space, and I think it's becoming sort of more broadly known that these are real questions and things to contend with. And I think we're encountering more and more families who are willing to really explore that and figure out how to prepare themselves and how to help have those kinds of conversations with their kiddos. And so I'm super encouraged by that. I think that we're moving in the right direction, so to speak, from where things have been. But I think it's for sure something that I would hope parents are able to kind of go into with kind of eyes wide open. I think it's a really important thing to pay attention to.
Yeah, I totally agree, especially with that, you know, that adoptive piece. But even there's something so much more simple about what you're talking about. And I've read a lot of commentators, Alan Noble comes to mind, just about how our society, how a modern American culture just is not interested in forming children's identities in general, right? It's just like, you could literally be anything. You could be a boy, you could be a girl, you could, you know, sexuality is sort of on this spectrum, you know? And our culture just thinks that there's maybe this inherent, like you're trying to discover this like inherent identity that you have or something, as opposed to forming an identity through church or, you know, through even a family structure like has happened in the past. And I think what you're talking about is like, I think parents aren't cognizant enough in general. And I put myself in that category, not always thinking through how am I like really forming this young person's identity? How am I helping them kind of see who they are, that they're a child of God, a Blandford, you know, second most. And then, you know, from there, everything else goes from there, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah. 100%. I was writing on this yesterday, cause I came across, gosh, whatever the quote was, I came across this quote yesterday that was kind of taking a look at sort of the function of creativity. And as I was kind of reflecting on the particular quote, it surfaced something for me that I thought, you know, actually, this was really profound for me, at least. I think especially as parents, you know, like I'm a creative, I make things all the time. I write songs and put together worship services and, you know, but I think maybe most fundamentally the greatest, creative work that I'm ever going to participate in is shaping and forming my children.
Ooh, that's good.
You know, and it dawned on me a really, really kind of a heavy way of as I look around the world and as I see all the brokenness and all the various ways, it's like, man, one of the most redemptive things that I can do is pour everything I have into my children and helping to shape them and form them and see that they grow up knowing who they are and whose they are. Because if they get that right, then they are just, you know, these little infinity boxes of good for the world, you know, as they grow up, whatever they're going to do, they're going to bring light and goodness into the spaces that they are. And that's going to flow from who they are. And so I was so just taken back by that kind of reflection yesterday of just like, you know, beyond the songs that I write or, you know, the worship services that I plan or, you know, the things I sing on a Sunday or, you know, whatever it looks like beyond all of those things are great and they help shape and form people in particular ways. But, you know, my primary calling, as a parent, is to be shaping my children, in the best of ways and in who God sees them as and who God calls them as. And that's, you know, like, let's do that as parents. Let's do that as believers, as people who follow this beautiful God who stepped out of heaven for us. Let's do that. Let's take that seriously, you know?
Yeah, no, that's such a good challenge. Even myself, I'm like, yeah, I'm taking that in. I'm drinking that in currently. I think that's good. I may want to even expand on that a little bit, even for people without kiddos in the home right now. Like, we have a responsibility as a church to be helping these young people sort of form their identity in general. I'm thinking of, like, you know, I'm working on the tech team now. I'm kind of overseeing the tech team at church, right? There's the soundboard, pro presenter, you know, live stream audio, right? But the young people, the teenagers, are the ones most excited to do this work, you know, because this is their world. They love this stuff, creating sounds and that sort of thing. And so, like, bringing them in and mentoring them is part of that. What you're talking about, I think, for older folks in the church, right? Like, bringing in young people and mentoring them is part of our call as Christians, I think.
Yeah, 100%. I think that there's a gentleman that I get to work with. I do some work at a local Christian college here in town, and he's one of the chaplains, and I love that one of the ways that he prays often is he uses this language of caught, and I think there's so much about, you know, church in quotes, that I think maybe in the Western context we maybe overemphasize this idea that it's something that is intellectually understood. As opposed to the body of Christ is really something to be experienced, is really something to be shaped and formed in, and has far less to do with, you know, the speech we give once a week or the, you know, the karaoke that we do once a week. Right. And it's more about the journey of faith and the journey of believers and finding a sense of belonging within this community. So I think I'm right there with you. I think that's, that's a huge responsibility. And I think that's what, you know, the first century church looked like, right? 100%. There wasn't, you know, didn't have all the bells and whistles that we got to work with today. But it was truly a community that was kind of shaped and formed around the person of Jesus. And yeah, I'm right there with you.
Yeah, I wonder if the bells and whistles don't make it harder for us to actually to do that work sometimes.
Yeah, 100%, 100%.
The way that that's just the, kind of how it goes, but it's something to be cognizant of, especially as leaders in the church, you know.
For sure, yeah.
It's good stuff. Well, yeah, let's talk about worship then. I mean, we're here. Let's talk about your journey. So how did you... When did you first realize, like, okay, I'm pretty good at this stuff. I love being creative. I love music. This is it.
Yeah. So, I was 7 years old, living in Ireland at the time, and my parents both were really musical, but didn't really have the opportunity to really develop that as kids. They just didn't have the means to, and so. That was kind of one of those like Morrow family rules, so to speak, was like all of our children are going to take music lessons. Cool. So I turned 7. I'm the youngest. You know, I've got 2 older siblings that were their biological kids. And so the question came, all right, Zawadi, you're 7. You got to start taking music lessons. You know, what's it going to be? The piano teacher who lived up the street from her house, he had a Dalmatian. And I just thought Dalmatians were the coolest dogs on the planet. And so my little 7-year-old brain was like, I want to do piano so that I can play with this dude's dog.
I love it.
And so the piano, here we go. And so that's where it started. I took music lessons really sort of all the way through from 7 up until I graduated high school. My parents really encouraged music. I excelled at it pretty well. And I had a couple of real key sort of mentors who really sort of saw that gift in me and kept encouraging that in me and putting me in different places to really get to use that gift. And so when we moved to the U.S., I got plugged into, we were living in North Carolina, went to Southern Baptist Church, got plugged into youth group there. And, you know, they were like, oh, Zawadi, you play, you should, you know, be in the band, and did that. And then that turned into like, oh, you should, you know, be the upfront guy. Even still at this point, I wasn't thinking like, you know, worship leader career path. It just was like, yeah, I play music. So I'll do it at church on Sundays while I'm here, you know? And then when I, my senior year of high school, you know, everyone's kind of trying to figure out what they want to do for college. And I had like a little mini sort of crisis where I was like, okay, my parents were also kind of delightfully pushy in encouraging music as well. So I kind of had this moment where it was like, am I doing this because I like it? Am I doing this because I'm good at it? Am I doing this because my parents have kind of pushed me into this? And I kind of come to the conclusion, you know what? I think I'm going to end my musical journey here. I'll do something else in college and call it good. And my piano teacher at the time was like devastated. And was like, this is, you know, you're like one of my better students. You should be doing this. And I was like, no, made up my mind. I'm not going to do it. And he was like, okay, fine. Well, here's this one last thing I want you to do. There was this competition, sort of a concerto competition. And he was like, let's spend this last year working towards that. That'll kind of be your final thing that you do. Worked up towards it, entered, got all the way through to the finals, ended up being the runner up. And the dude that won, ended up not accepting the sort of grand prize, so to speak, which was a full ride music scholarship. So it came to me.
Oh my gosh.
So I was kind of faced with this little like, okay, either I have college fully paid for with the stipulation that I got to do music, or do I really not like music that much and I'm going to turn down a free, you know, a full ride scholarship?
Wow.
That's crazy. So I was like, you know what? I actually do like music. I do enjoy it. So I jumped into undergrad, really just tried to take advantage of you know, all the musical opportunities I had. It was, you know, everything was paid for, which was a total gift from the Lord. You know, especially with missionary parents, that was a that was a big deal. And then my senior year of undergrad, my parents were really pushing me to get a master's, and I was like, yeah, but in the music world, like, your only options are like classical music or you know, jazz. And I was like, I'm not hyper passionate about either of those things to want to go do more training in them. And so a buddy of my dad's knew a guy who was a law professor at Liberty University up in Virginia. And he told my dad, he was like, hey, they have just like started this new like worship program in their seminary. Like, I know your son leads worship on Sundays at church. Like, maybe he'd be interested in that. This was like not on my radar at all. And so my dad told me, hey, you should go check out this thing. And I was like, Dad, it was the last thing in the world I want to do. But okay, you know, whatever, I'll be a good son and I'll go check it out and just then tell you, look, I checked it out, not for me. So drove up, it was Martin Luther King weekend. So it was Monday, classes were off. I met the dean of the worship school of music there. I was sitting in his office and we were talking, and he was kind of giving me the, you know, scope of the program. And about an hour into our conversation, you know, had this like weird, like Paul on the road to Damascus moment kind of thing, where I just felt like overcome with a sense of like, oh, this is what I'm supposed to do with my life. And it was so bizarre. I'd never experienced anything like that in my life before. And so I told the dude sitting across from me, I was like, hey, this is weird. I don't mean to like interrupt you, but like, here's what's happening inside. I was like, I don't quite know what to do with it, but you're here, so I'm telling you. And he was like, okay, yeah, cool, all right. So we go on about the rest of the day. I tour campus, and towards the end of the day, I'm like starting to ask like actual questions about the program. Like, okay, you know, how do I get in? And I was about to get engaged to my wife at this point, and you know, I was like, hey, I'm about to get engaged. We're getting married this summer. You know, I literally have no money. Are there scholarships? Like, what? You know, trying to get the details. He was like, yeah, we have a couple of like graduate teaching assistant type roles, and those cover, you know, tuition essentially. He was like, we've got a couple of those, but they're pretty competitive, you know, given what they are. And I was like, okay, that's fine. That's good to know. And so we were on our way back, and we swung through the seminary office towards the tail end of the day, and we walk in, and there's a couple gentlemen who are standing there chatting. He's like, oh, this is really weird. Like, these are the two dudes that like distribute who gets those, you know. Weird that they're here. It's the day off. I'll introduce you. You know. So he introduced me to them. We talked, I kind of shared some of my story, and they, like, one of the dudes was like, man, really seems like God really wants you here. So he like called his assistant or secretary or something, and they were like, I know it's your day off, but like, we got to figure this out. They called my undergrad. They got all my transcripts sent over, like everything. And I was driving home end of the day, and all my stuff had been sent over. I'd been accepted to the program. I've got this scholarship that's going to cover tuition. And, you know, I'm just kind of like, what just happened today? And then it dawned on me, oh, I probably should call my girlfriend, soon to be wife. I was like, okay, hey, how do you feel about moving to Virginia for a few years for me to go to seminary? Because that was never part of the conversation. She's incredible and gracious. She was like, yeah, let's talk more. But like, sounds like God's really doing something here. And so that's how things kind of got started. totally kind of the Lord's leading. And I felt like, you know, and specifically as far as like serving the church goes, yeah, God kind of just was like, and this is what you're going to do. And so it's been such a cool journey. I've gotten to sort of do this in both the church context and in higher education, Christian higher ed as well for a number of years. You know, I've done everything from church plant land to mega church land and everything in between. And it's a gift, and I love it. There's something about just being able to be the one kind of responsible for helping give language to the church in order for them to sing and worship and kind of help lead some of that, guide some of that, and create spaces and opportunities for people to do that. And just to get to stand up in front of a room of the body of Christ and just hear them sing and worship. It's, you know, it's one of my favorite things in the world. It's an absolute gift that I get to do it.
So. That's cool. I love that. I did not know you went to Liberty for grad school.
Yeah.
That's I did not have that on my bingo card there, yeah, I guess.
It is a layer of many layers.
that would have been what, in 09? You said you got married in 09.
So yeah, you started grad school in 09 through 09? Yep, 09 through almost 12.
Okay.
Started an MDiv. And then about a year into it, was like, I don't need these languages. So I cut out the the Greek and the Hebrew and came out with an MA, essentially. MA,
yeah. So. Okay. Wow. That's cool. I guess that would have been pre some of the turmoil kind of that went on at Liberty there and some of that. But
for sure. There was a few kind of rumblings of you know, quote unquote shenanigans behind the scenes and some culture stuff there, even at that time. But, you know, I think with so many places, in any institution whatsoever, there's some beautiful things that are at work there, and there's some human brokenness that's at work there. And, you know, you kind of pray, Lord, in your mercy, help us get through this, and let's hold on to the good and let go of the not so good. And I feel like I was able to do that through my experience there. And so, yeah, grateful for it.
I get it. I went to Moody. I mean, it has its similar things there. Yep. You know, not to the same extent. It's just not as big of a school at all.
Yeah.
But you know, you have your cultural things, and I think that's a great way to put it.
Yep.
Take the good and leave the bad and call it a day, you know?
Yeah.
Awesome. Okay. So, I mean, you've led worship pretty much your entire career. You've been part of bands, you know, done a lot of creative work. And now you're in the Midwest, apparently, I'm finding out, leading worship. So, do you want to talk through any of that kind of story?
Totally.
Yeah.
So, I moved out to Seattle after we finished up our time at Liberty. My wife and I, we moved out there I got a job at Seattle Pacific University, which is right sort of Queen Anne north into Seattle downtown. Beautiful campus, super historic Christian university there. And I was kind of responsible for sort of like overseeing their chapel program and kind of running that. So I did that for 5 years in that capacity, and did a little bit of adjunct teaching in their music department while I was there. And my first year that I moved out there, one of the things that I did, which just seemed like the right thing to do, was sort of try to get in touch with as many kind of worship leaders in town and just build some relationships. And so I spent the first year just connecting with folks. And one of the first folks I got connected with was a guy named Chad Gardner, who fronts King's Kaleidoscope. And this was like early days of King's, kind of tail end of Mars Hill, not quite. And so Chad well, and I, so
for people who don't understand, like, what's the connection with King's Kaleidoscope and Mars yeah. Hill?
So King's used to be a one of the worship teams, worship bands at Mars Hill. They were originally formed at the University District campus. It's a bunch of college kids, you know, that love Jesus and love playing music. And Chad was an intern at Mars Hill at the time. And then after he finished up his internship, then they brought him on staff full time. And so King's kind of became sort of one of the main kind of worship bands there on Sunday mornings. And they had then moved from the U District campus over to the Ballard campus. When they had moved Mark Driscoll over to Bellevue, that became like the main broadcast campus at the time. But they wanted to be sure they didn't lose too many people with him moving. So they're like, well, we'll bring everybody's favorite band over to Ballard and maybe they'll stay for that. You know, trying to build megachurch land. Yeah. So I got involved. Chad was like, hey, you should come and play with Kings. And I was like, that'd be a blast. But I was still involved in some stuff on Sunday nights over at the university. And at the time, I mean, things were humming along over there in Mars Hill. We were doing, I think, 5 services a day at the Ballard campus.
You were leading worship for 5 services?
Yeah, 5 services on a Sunday. Gosh. We'd get there at about 6 in the morning. And I didn't leave until like after 10 that night. I mean, it was just a whole day of it was wild at the time. We had literally had like these little cots backstage where you could like sleep, and you know, folks in the congregation would like bring lunch and bring dinner and that sort of thing. So you get to be taken care of that way. But yeah, such a wild time. For sure. And then, yeah, towards the last few years there, Chad at first, but a number of us in the band were just starting to see some stuff kind of behind the scenes that just wasn't healthy and wasn't helpful. And you know, over the course of a year and a half, 2 years almost, we just began to see like some of the people that we really looked up to and valued in terms of pastors and elders the most, just having some real challenges with some of the decisions that were being made and kind of how power was being consolidated. And I know there's plenty to hear about Mars Hill's story. But we all kind of decided we're going to step away from this thing. And kind of in that process, it was interesting. We were in the middle of, we had done probably like 75% so Mars Hill had a music label as well. And King's was like 70% done kind of recording a full length album for the church for Mars Hill, when we left. And so, kind of went to the leadership there and just said, hey, you know, would you let us at least like buy the masters from you so we can, you know, release the album? There was some issues there. They didn't want to sell it. So whatever. Anyway, we scrounged a bunch of money together, recorded the record ourselves and put it out. And at that point, there really wasn't a vision kind of beyond that. Like, we had always been a church band, you know? And so it was very much just like, well, God gave us these songs. We just want to get those out. Maybe they'll bless some people. And then we'll all kind of move on and figure out what to do with life. But after that first record came out, Becoming Who We Are, we just continue to get calls and get invited to places to play. And it kind of became clear like, oh, maybe this is like a thing, you know? And so, yeah, King's has blossomed from there. And so I was involved, sort of from that point all the way up through really full time until like 2019, 2020. I kind of stepped away full time. I had sort of a little hiatus in 2019 because we had adopted our daughter and brought her home. And so I was like, I need to be home for a year to just get a sense of home and place and family rooted. I don't need to be touring every, you know, so many weeks. So I was still involved, you know, we were writing a Zeal record at the time, I think. And so still involved in studio stuff at home, but wasn't going out on the road. And then 2020 pandemic hit, everybody's favorite year. Through that experience, my wife and I just really sensed like, you know, it helped kind of reprioritize stuff, I think, for everybody. And we were like, man, this is getting harder and harder to be kind of so far away from our family. So my parents were living here in Michigan at the time. Her family were still back in North Carolina. And so she was the one that was really like, you know, this is really a great opportunity for us to maybe rethink that. And so we kind of began to explore what it would look like for us to move to be closer to family. And my parents are in their 80s now. And you know, also just for us to desire for our children to have a relationship with their grandparents that's beyond just, you know, once a year at Christmas or over summer vacation or whatever. And so that was kind of the impetus for us to kind of make the move here to the Midwest to be closer to them. And so that kind of spawned that move. And so, yeah, as a creative, I think one of the things that I feared a little bit in that move was just like, I've got all these relationships in the music world and all these things that sort of exist in Seattle. What's that going to be like sort of moving like small town Midwest,
yeah.
You know? And that was a real fear I think that I had. But man, God has just been so kind and faithful in that and just continue to create opportunities for me and to be able to see that, like, you know, oh yeah, actually one of the other random side effects of the pandemic is we all figured out how to work together, not in the same room. And so that distance is maybe less consequential as maybe it used to be kind of pre-pandemic time. So yeah, it's given me an opportunity to continue to collaborate. You know, I've continued to play on a bunch of King's records over the last few years and yeah, it's been fun to hop up on stage with the guys anytime they come through town and just kind of stay connected in those sorts of ways. So yeah, grateful for that. But that is kind of what made that move.
Yeah, so. I love that. That's a great story. Ours was, we did the same thing, moving from Illinois to Texas back to be near family again. So, but it just makes sense from your story. You got the East Coast, you got the West Coast, and now you have to do the Midwest. You know, you're,
we got to check them all off, you know?
Yeah, that's right. I love it. Okay. I would love to just pick your brain a little bit just about worship since this is what you've done for a long time. And just kind of how you think about what you're doing when you lead worship. And I guess some of the context I'm coming from is like, I preach and I love preaching. There's nothing like preaching. It sounds like a lot the way you experience worship, except that when I'm preaching, it's just me and like a Bible and a microphone, you know, yeah. but worship is so complicated, right? You've got tracks running, you've got several instruments, maybe many instruments. You've got soundboards, you've got monitors. I mean, it's just a whole other thing. So how do you think about the worship process and do you keep like the technical side of things from being like a distraction to you on that?
100%. I have been shaped and formed. I think a big mentor of mine is a guy named Stephen Newby. He always encouraged me in the sense of like worship is this thing that we have that is supposed to serve our, or maybe I should put it this way, the singing and all the stuff that we use, they're there to kind of serve our worship of God. They're not essential, they're not necessary, they're not, you know. And this is true of my own experience. Like, you know, when I lived in Africa, church was like under a tree. When I lived, you know, in the UK, church was in like these old, beautiful cathedrals and buildings that have been around for years and years and years. Then I moved to the States and, you know, it's a black box with lights and you know, yeah. It's a whole different thing, right? So it's the container that we do this inside of matters very little. They're all just tools kind of designed to help us commune with, you know, the God of the universe, right? So I've always kind of held them loosely. They're tools, and when they help direct our attention and our affections toward God, great. When they don't, then they're out. Hmm. We don't, you know, they've got to serve that purpose, right? And so I've always approached worship leadership in that way. And some real practical sort of things that I think about. I think some of this is like just perspective, like I said, of being in the congregational perspective, getting to worship in a bunch of different contexts and varieties, but then also from a leadership standpoint, getting to be, you know, a worship leader at a church plant where it's like, it's just me and a couple of, you know, averagely skilled individuals, you know, yeah. All the way up to like, yeah, the big church stuff, the big productions with all the bells and whistles, and we're running click tracks and we've got, you know, a massive band and everything's like time coded and synced with the lights and the, you know,
yep.
Pro presenter and all that stuff. And that's great too. But at the end of the day, like, you got to keep the main thing. These are all just tools that we use to worship God. And so there's like a practical preparation for me oftentimes is, you know, we got the tools that we use. Great. So I've got to be skillful enough and understand how those things work, and be able to navigate and sort of perform or produce freely within the context and the structures of those things. So I've got to learn those things well as a worship leader in order to understand how they work. But also, I think similarly, as I prepare, you know, for me, it's like I need to understand, say I'm leading a song. I want to be able to understand this song in the context of all the stuff, and I want to be able to understand the song in the context of just me and an instrument. And I think that's significant, important. And I want to understand it in the context of the whole service as well. Like, what is this song? How is this song serving the direction of the service, serving where we're trying to take the people of God in this time together? And so oftentimes there's, on the preparation side of things, there's like, okay, God, you know, how do you want to lead us? How do you want to speak to us in this upcoming service? And we plan and we put all this stuff together. But then even on the day of, even in the middle of the service, my internal dialogue is still very much like, God, are we on the right track? Like, is this where you have us? Is this what you want to hear from us? And sometimes that comes with actually, I want to do this. And so it's that also comes with a level of freedom to know that we're not shackled by these tools. We're going to go here because we're sensing the Spirit's leading us this direction. And that's okay. And that, you know, that happens. And I think there has to be like an openness to that and a flexibility to that. And I think a real, again, awareness of like, these are just tools, you know, and when they help us in assisting our worship, great, we use them. If they stop being helpful at any point, we don't need to use them. If we find ourselves being really dependent on them, that's a good check, you know, that's a good checks and balances there. Like, do we always have to have, you know, the full band and the lights and the show in order to feel like we worshiped? And it's like, if that's a real thing, like, well, then we're not worshiping God here. There's something else that's happening. And I think that's an important sort of thing, I would say, especially as worship leaders, as folks who are planning these services, putting these services together, that's an important question to ask yourselves regularly. I think it's so important.
Yeah, I agree. That is an incredible insight. And it strikes me as those are really hard questions to ask, because those things make you sound a lot better a lot of times.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. And like, could kind of smooth over, or maybe any. So I guess we use those things a lot of times because of what's happening in internally, mm-hmm. right? Like maybe a insecurities or, you know, that can be a reason for using those. There could be lots of reasons, but it's a much harder question than just, is this useful? It's like, there's a why there. Like, do I need this? Is a is a really complicated kind of emotional question, maybe. I
100%. And I think it's harder now for sort of, what do I want to say, like the average church, so to speak, because now more than ever, like, it's so easy for us to see what the big churches are doing, you know, and it's so easy for us to think, or maybe wrongly assume, like, oh yeah, we should be able to do that. You know, Elevation just came out with a new record, and it's great, and it's beautiful and phenomenal, and you know, all the bells and whistles, and I've got buddies who are involved in that, and that's cool. But like, no other church in America has any business attempting to do all that they do, right?
Yeah.
But there's maybe this false belief or this false expectation that, like, oh, that's what worship looks like. You know, I had one of my students who just went to one of the Elevation nights here in town a couple nights ago, and was like, it was amazing. And I'm sure it was, because they put on an amazing show and a production, the whole thing. But at the same time, like, I would hope that in my prayer would be that, like, and I know this is true of this particular student, but like, she can have as meaningful an encounter with God when it's, you know, on a Wednesday morning at 7 a.m. with the worship team before chapel on campus, and it's just the team in a circle, and we've just shared our highs and lows, and we've prayed for each other, and someone's grabbed an acoustic guitar, and we're singing a song before we jump into rehearsal. Both, like, it's both of those things. And I think especially as leaders, we've got to be careful as we, you know, try to build our churches, as we try to lead our congregation. I think we've got to be really careful that we're not chasing this idol of production and quality. Like, it's beautiful and it's helpful, but it's not it. And if the people that God has entrusted you with don't possess those skills or those tools or the financial capability to do that, then you need to get that vision out of your head and pursue, how do I serve these people given all the tools and resources and the people that we have? What does true, right, honest worship look like for us? Ask those questions, figure that out, and then go do that. You know, that's what God's after, I think.
Yeah, that is so good, Zawadi. I so appreciate you going into that. I could literally talk to you about this all day, I think. I want to be respectful of your time. I sure. want to get to a new endeavor you're jumping into called No More Orphans. Do you mind just talking to us about it?
Totally. So at some point last year, or maybe I'll go back briefly, even a few more years, back in like 2021, I believe it was, I got a call from an organization called Christian Alliance for Orphans. And they do like a big kind of summit conference every year. Here in the States, it's usually a city at a, you know, big host church, and they're kind of bringing in folks from all over the country, all over the world, kind of involved in adoption, foster care, vulnerable children care, that sort of thing. So I got the call, and they were like, hey, we do this thing every year. We'd love for you to come lead worship for it. And I was like, cool. I don't know where you got my name. I definitely am not advertising myself as a, you know, itinerant conference worship leader. So I like knew really very little about the organization. But showed up and it was in Atlanta that year and led worship, and it was really one of the most sort of holistic experiences I've ever had of leading worship. And it because I think there were two things at play that I just never thought would sort of intersect in my life, which was sort of the world of like worship leading and music and what I do there with the world of like vulnerable children care and foster care and adoption. And so much of that's part of my identity. to some degree, and sort of to see those worlds come together, and to sort of be in a room leading, you know, several thousand individuals who are all part of this in some way, whether they're adoptees or parents or foster parents who are there because they're at the end of the rope and they don't know how to love their kids. Like, the sound that came out of this room was just unbelievable. And it was really like one of the most genuinely overwhelming experiences I've ever had leading worship before. And I remember I was sitting at the airport waiting to fly back home, and I fired off this prayer to the Lord. I just said, this was one of the most meaningful experiences of my life. And if it's in the cards, I would love to do more of this. I don't know what that looks like. But I would love to get to give my life to this kind of thing. And so that was kind of the genesis. And so a couple months later, they reached out and they were like, "Hey man, we really loved having you lead worship. Like, would you come back and do it again?" I was like, yeah, 100%. And so I came back the next year. Third year, the invitation came back around, and that time it came with a little bit more of a, "We'd love to have you kind of be more involved in what we do." And so one of the things that I got to do that particular year was sort of lead a songwriting retreat where we brought a bunch of artists together at the Worship Initiative down in Dallas, and we wrote and I produced and released a short little single EP of a handful of songs from that. And so over these last, you know, 5 years or so, I feel like God has been drawing my heart more and more to kind of see me get to contribute my gifts sort of to this world of vulnerable children care. And so last year is when it really kind of came to a head, and I really, really sensed the Lord saying, you know, I kind of want you to step out and kind of put your name to some of this in kind of a meaningful way. And so, I released a song, gosh, last fall, a few months ago, called The Justice Song. It's just a sort of, "Okay, Lord, I'll do it." And I have kind of, over the last few months, continued to sense like, okay, this is going to be a space where I can share my story, my experience, and my gifts, to kind of all help, bring light and awareness and kind of leverage those things to see, to maybe be a part of seeing this world slowly move towards a place where there are no more orphans, you know? Yeah. And so that's kind of what it's become. It's sort of this like little creative deposit of music and storytelling and merch design and kind of all of these things. And this has been so much fun for me. Every single thing that we make off of this goes directly to support a family who's in the adoption process or a foster family or that sort of thing. And so it just has been such a joy to kind of get to do this. And this year I've kind of, you know, prayerfully heard from the Lord, like, "Hey, I'm going to try to release a song a month this year." And so I've been writing a bunch, from a creative challenge standpoint, that's been a big deal because I've been trying to do every part of this process, the songwriting and the arranging and the producing and the recording.
Wow.
I've got a couple of buddies who are helping me mix and master, and that, because that's a whole other
world.
Yeah,
it's its own thing, right?
Yeah. But essentially every other piece of the pie, I'm kind of doing, you know, at home in my basement in my little studio, and I'm having the time of my life. It's been so much fun, and I just released a song last month that kind of tells a little bit of the story of my wife and I, and then our son, and then coming to our daughter, and she's been kind of struggling a little bit with some identity stuff lately. And we've been continuing to affirm who she is and that sort of thing. But the other day she came up to me and she's been singing this song for the last month. And she was like, so Dad, did you like, you really did like pray for me and spend all of this time, you know, pouring over all this paperwork and like traveling to the other side of the world. And you like, you really did do all that because you love me, right? Like, just like in the song. And I was like, Yep, exactly. And it has been just such a gift to me to hear her just dancing around the house, singing the lyrics to, you know, kind of her story. And who knew? Like this was the Lord. Like I could have never predicted that, you know, that would be maybe part of the key that helped her find a real sense of belonging again in this little season of, you know, questioning for her. So yeah, it's been such a cool thing. I'm finding a lot of joy in doing it in purpose and even just to be able to hear, it's really given me an opportunity to get to share, and receive from a lot of people their different stories of adoption, of foster care. And some of those are beautiful stories and some of those are really hard stories. And try to hold those and create space for those. And some of those stories are like continuing to inform the music that I'm writing. And so, yeah, I'm really enjoying it. And I think I'm seeing sort of this confluence of kind of who I am and try to help answer the question of like, okay, Lord, as I look into this next decade of my life, what is it that you've put me specifically on the earth to do? Let me like pursue that fully and wholly. And this little No More Orphans endeavor has very much been part of that. So it's been a gift to jump into it, and I'm so pumped to get to see it through for the rest of the year and beyond, hopefully. So
I love it. I love it. I just came across it on Instagram. It popped up and I'm like, oh my gosh, Zawadi's doing something new. That's awesome. So I love it. What are the easiest ways for people to kind of support you? I know following, you know, along on Instagram.
Yeah.
Checking out merch. I've already checked out merch. It looks awesome. I've got my eyes on a couple things. So
sweet.
What are the best things for us to do?
Yeah, I think give us a follow on Instagram. That would be wonderful. The website I think is nomoreorphans.co. Yeah, we've got some merch there. Literally 100% of everything that comes in from the merch is going to support a family. Right now it's a husband and wife and a daughter. They're American and Venezuelan, and they're in the adoption process with a little one in Colombia. And so, you know, anything that's coming in right now is going directly to them. And so that's a real gift. And then, yeah, I hop on Spotify, you know, or Apple Music or whatever your poison you choose. Take a look, take a listen, you know, share some of the music. There's some real fun stuff in the pipeline ahead. I think it's Friday. Yeah. Had a song just come out today.
Oh, nice.
Today's song is really cool. It's called I Have a Name, and it's about sort of the significance of sort of me coming to grips with understanding like the God who placed every star in the sky and knows like the hairs on my head, like he knows me by name. And just like the significance of my name is really beautiful, and there's a lot of meaning and power behind the name that I was given. And I kind of share a little bit of that on Instagram, if you can go listen to it there. But even if that's not necessarily the reality for you as an adoptee or whatever, the reality is that God, the creator of the universe, he knows you by name. He calls you by name. And so who does he say that you are? Pay attention to that voice, and then live fully out of that reality, that identity. So, it was a really, really cool song. I enjoyed writing, and tried to kind of put it in like a sort of fun pop tune that you can just like sing and dance to and kind of celebrate the reality that you're known by your heavenly Father who loves you and calls you by name. So yeah.
I love it. I'll make sure all that's in the show notes too, so people can access it easily. Excited to check it out, man. I love it. Okay. Well, you cool jumping into the final two questions just as we kind of wrap up here?
Let's do it.
All right. So my first question is, what is the strangest job that you have ever had?
Ooh, that's a good question. You know, the one that pops into my mind right away when you said that, I was a ski lift operator in college for a couple of years, kind of out of left field for me. I didn't enjoy it very much. but I did it the first year because I wanted to take advantage of getting to do some skiing. And skiing's not the cheapest thing in the world. And I was like, well, here, if I work at the hill, then I can ski for free. Turns out I didn't enjoy the work very much. And so I ended up not actually doing a whole lot of skiing because that's the way it kind of went out. But yeah, it's an interesting side mission in my life.
So you were stopping the lift, like if people fell or something?
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Oh, okay. Yep. Okay. Yep. So I'd sit there and you could be stationed at the bottom of the hill helping people get on the lift. That was like the worst because you had to be outside the whole time and it's freezing cold most of the time. Or there were like midway stations up the hill. Those were the best because you could sit in your little hut and just watch stuff go by. Those are the ideal spots. And then up at the top, a little bit more work up at the top, you know, with people getting off and you have to slow down the lift or stop if people fall on that sort of thing. But yeah, it is an interesting gig.
That's legit. I love it. Okay, so my final question then is, what is one piece of advice you would give to somebody looking to bring God's kingdom more into their work?
I think it stems from sort of this piece of identity. Kind of like I said recently, I have really been asking this question of God, there's a lot of things that I can do in the world. But like right here, right now, what am I supposed to be doing in the world? What do you want me to be doing? And asking that question and trying to really listen for the Holy Spirit's answer in that. I think there's you know, especially in our Western world, it's so easy for us to kind of autopilot our way through life. You know, especially if you've got a place to live and you've got a job that's paying the bills, you know, and your kids are in school and or whatever, things are predictable. It's kind of easy to just sort of autopilot that and kind of cruise through life. But I've been finding a lot of purpose and meaning in just really setting aside time to ask the Lord, okay, right here, right now, in the spaces you have me, the place I work, the relationships I'm in, like where I live, all these things, like, what do you have for me to do particularly that can help bring light and joy and purpose to your kingdom? And I think just being honest about and intentional about praying that kind of a prayer and taking the time to listen, you know, and I think praying that prayer often, I think sometimes that comes with like real big, profound answers from the Lord. And sometimes that comes with really simple, like, you know, I just want you to go feed that dude, you know, on the corner. That's what I have for you to do today, you know? But taking the time to ask those questions of the Lord, I think is maybe the answer I'd give.
I love it. That's a great answer. That's a great challenge. So Zwadi, it was so good to reconnect, man. Yeah. I love talking to you. It's good stuff.
Likewise, man. This has been super, super fun. Thanks for the chat.
Thanks so much for hanging out and listening to A Theology of Hustle. Make sure that you like and subscribe, all the things, and follow me at Theology of Hustle on Instagram. My hope is that this podcast just encourages you in your work, whatever that may be. So until next time, get out there and hustle.